So I think it's about building really great teams and then giving the teams the autonomy to work the way that they work best. And how would you do that? I mean, I think one of the important things for leaders to do, and one that I think maybe is underrated, is helping people prioritize. So when there's a lot of work on, if people know what they've got to get done first, what order that things need to be happening in, then they can start structuring how to make that happen.
Hey everyone, thanks for joining me, and it's great to be talking to you for another episode of the podcast. In this episode, episode number 23, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Patricia Riddell, who is a consultant neuroscientist specializing in how neuroscience can be applied in the business world to support and extend our understanding of human behavior. Patricia provides access to applied neuroscience through customized training, consultancy, and public programs. She teaches at several business schools, including Henley, as well as running training programs for organizations and businesses. She is also an author, having co-authored a book, written several chapters, and many academic articles in the areas of coaching and leadership. So you can see why I'm so excited to have her on the show today. In recent years, I've really started to hear neuroscience findings being used more and more in the business world. I've also begun to realize that much of this is misquoted, misunderstood, or is simply out of date information. With that in mind, I really tried to focus my conversation and the interview with Patricia Riddell on debunking a lot of the false information and myths that exist around neuroscience, and then shift us into some of the practical ways in which we can use the real findings, the real information, to improve our own productivity and become even better leaders for those that we serve. So, without any further delays or introductions, please enjoy my conversation with Professor Patricia Riddell. Hello, Trish. Welcome to the podcast. It's fantastic to be talking to you today. Before we get stuck in, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. Yeah, good to be here.
Good, good. So, Trish, the very first question I always love to ask people who come on the show is the backstory question. So, could you just give us a sort of brief overview of who you are, what you're doing, and a little of the journey that's gotten you here, please?
Okay, I'm Professor Patricia Riddell. I'm a professor of applied neuroscience. And how did I get here today? Well, for 30 years, I was a dyed-in-the-wool academic, and I thought that was just going to be my life. And then somebody asked me to consider a question that was very practical. So it was somebody who does training, and they asked, how do you get better transference of learning from the training room into the workplace? And I went away and did a whole lot of reading about what I understand from my psychology and neuroscience background and came up with some answers. And before I took them back, I thought, I'm not an expert in memory, and this is about memory and learning. So I'll take it to a colleague who is an expert in memory and learning and just check that I'm not saying anything wrong. So when I went to this colleague and said, look, these are the things I'm thinking of saying, he looked at the list and he said, do you know, there's nothing wrong with what you said, but I would never have thought about using what I know in that way. He said, you know, that practical application would never have come to my mind at all. And I think that was the moment that I realized that there was a gap and that there was a gap that I could actually fill. And since then, I've just been moving more and more into the applied neuroscience field and really be, you know, I now have my own consultancy and I go into organizations, I run open programs where I'm bringing the neuroscience, but in a really applied way. There's no point in you knowing about this stuff unless you can do something with it. So, and I absolutely love, you know, hearing the challenges that are in organizations and helping them to think about, well, what must be happening in people's brains and therefore what can we do that will help them? So that's my life now and I absolutely love it.
Amazing. And I'm really excited about our conversation today, Trish, because we were chatting just now before we hit record. I think over the, I'm not sure what the time frame is, maybe the last 5 years, certainly, sort of in the field of leadership, personal development, training, there just seems to have been more and more written about neuroscience, kind of more being taught and spoken about it. And I've spoken and taught a lot on the topic myself. But what I've started to realize, I think, in the last 12 to 18 months is that much of that that is being shared isn't necessarily that accurate. Sometimes it just isn't even factually right, perhaps. And then some of it is, or seems to be, based on quite old, perhaps outdated science. So I guess what I'm getting at is there seems to be a lot of myths around neuroscience right now. So with that as the backdrop, what do you think are some of the most common sort of myths around neuroscience that perhaps need dispelling, and especially for those of us in leadership and management positions?
So I think for me, one of the most important ones is I still hear a lot of people talking about the triune brain. And the triune brain is a model that was developed in, 60 years ago, 1959. And while it was useful then, I don't think it's helpful now, because I think it gives people an idea that the brain works in bits, and you know that you've got your brainstem and it's doing one set of things, and you've got your limbic system and it's doing another set of things, and then you've got your cortex and it's doing something else. And that's not how the brain works at all. And I think if there was one thing that I have become fascinated with about the brain is the degree to which it's a dynamic and constantly shifting organ. So what it does really, really well is to bring together the bits that it needs in order to fulfill the function or the goal that you currently have. So if your goal at one point in time is to make some decisions in the workplace, then you're going to need ventromedial prefrontal cortex, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, your memory, hippocampus, a number of different bits that will be required to make good decisions. And the brain organizes itself by synchronizing the timing of the activity in those parts so that they work really well together. But as soon as that's done and you're doing something else, then a different set of areas will be synchronized to fulfill the next task that you've got to do. So this idea that there would be one bit that's doing one thing and another bit that's doing another thing, I think is very unhelpful. That's certainly one. And I think that goes on to, you know, anything where you say right brain, left brain people, nope. Male brains and female brains, nope. It's much more an organ that fulfills the goals that we have, and therefore it uses all of the bits and it uses them similarly whether you're a male or a female. There are small differences between males and females, but they're much less than the difference between individuals.
Great. Something that's really started to crop up in my mind a lot lately. I think so often I see and read things that talk about how we've evolved as human beings and the fight or flight or freeze response, and how it used to serve us well sort of when humans were sort of first hunting and gathering and kind of surviving in our tribes, and how the brain or we as humans haven't really kind of evolved. So we're still using sort of that same system or same brain, perhaps, not sure what the correct language is, in the modern world, whilst we're facing like different threats, like the threat from an imposing work deadline or something. Mm-hmm. And whenever I hear that, I always think, when's the brain going to catch up? Like, how long do we have to wait before we evolve? Because it seems like an old excuse to use in some ways. Like, what's the thinking around that?
Okay, so I kind of agree with that. And the biggest problem that we've got is that the rate of evolution has to some extent slowed down, because if you think about the primitive environments where a lot of evolution occurred, there was a great deal of chance that people would die. And so natural selection was able to run as a useful mechanism, because the people that didn't adapt to the new conditions died. And so their genetic information was lost. But nowadays, we don't die just because we get a decision wrong in the workplace. So one of the mechanisms of evolution is much less effective than it used to be. And therefore, the way that we evolve in some ways has slowed down a bit. So I think the better answer to this is to gain an understanding of what these systems are for, how they operate, and how we can get better at using them in ways that are effective in the modern world. So, for instance, the stress response, one of the things that I think is really interesting about that is that it operates on the basis not of the stress that's out in the world, but perceived stress. And getting an understanding of what it is that's causing you to be stressed is often the story that you tell yourself. Then we can give people mechanisms where they're better able to deal with those the stresses in the workplace and to manage them better for themselves. But having said that, I think that should not be made as an excuse for organisations to think that stress has to be dealt with by individuals and not by the organisation themselves.
And what about some of the myths or maybe even the solutions, right, to around productivity, creativity, neuroscience? You already touched there on sort of the left brain, kind of right brain. But are there any particular myths that you hear people talking about in terms of productivity that you think need dispelling?
So one of the things about productivity, and this comes in with one of my real bugbears, is about organisations that say we want our people to be more resilient. And productivity seems to be about having people that are able to cope with, you know, constant change and being able to deal with the big disruptions and just go on with things. So there's two things that I worry about there. One is that if you look up a definition of organizational resilience, it makes a lot of sense. It's about organizations being able to cope with change and to cope with the disruptions that happen as a normal part of the world that we're working in at the moment. But if you look at psychological resilience is the ability to bounce back from trauma or from, you know, a major event that's caused you a great deal of personal disruption. And I worry that when organizations are asking for the people to be resilient, that what they're saying is, we want to be able to allow you a degree of trauma in our organizations and for our people to be able to cope with that. And for me, that's completely the wrong way of looking at it. For me, it's about how do you prevent people from being traumatized rather than thinking it's okay to traumatize people. So I have got a big bugbear about organizational resilience. And with that comes this idea that productivity is gained by people doing more. And in fact, there was a recent study that's released from Henley Business School where they have got the data that shows that people are more productive in a 4-day week than they are in a 5-day week. And I don't mean proportionately, I mean more.
Wow.
And that doesn't surprise me at all, because I think people assume that when you leave work, your brain stops working on the questions that you've got or the, you know, the challenges that you're dealing with at work. And of course it doesn't. So if you can spend a day a week, you know, doing the garden while also letting your brain catch up with all the things that you need to think about, you'll end up with much more creative and innovative solutions to the challenges that you face at work than if people are working full tilt and don't have that time to just let their brain catch up. So it doesn't surprise me at all that we're more productive when we work slightly less than when we're full tilt working.
Wow, that's incredible. And Trish, do you have any thoughts or practical tips that you often share with senior leaders around how they can go about building some of that organizational resilience, I guess, in a positive way, without just sort of making it okay for there to be stress in the workplace and expect people to deal with it individually? What can the more committed, forward-thinking MD, CEO, senior leaders be thinking about or doing on that front?
So I think it's about building really great teams and then giving the teams the autonomy to work the way that they work best. And how would you do that? I mean, I think one of the important things for leaders to do, and one that I think maybe is underrated, is helping people prioritize. So when there's a lot of work on, if people know what they've got to get done first, what order that things need to be happening in, then they can start structuring how to make that happen. But when you just end up with, you know, we've got this, 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 and this to do, and we want it all done tomorrow, then you're going to get people feeling overwhelmed. So just sitting down with people, prioritizing their workload, thinking about what actually needs to be done first, that would be one thing. And that letting go control, I really think non-hierarchical workplaces work really well when people are able to say, this is where my expertise lies. I know how to get this stuff done. So if you just let me get on with it, then I will make sure that the end goal is reached. And I think we've seen a bit of that through the pandemic when more people are working at home. One of the things that I'm hearing people saying is that they feel as if they're being trusted more. And that trust is causing them to structure their days in the ways that's best for them, but is also most productive for the organization as well. So I think there's some lessons to be learned from what's happened over the pandemic that have really been helpful to us in realizing that things that we didn't think were possible are possible if you let go to some extent. But with that comes a responsibility of leaders to be able to notice where people are violating is a harsh word, but aren't really doing what the team agrees is the right thing to do. So if you've got, you know, some team rules about everybody should be available at meetings and we all turn on our videos and chat and connect properly, and we all, if we say we're going to do something, we get it done. If there's some things in place that everybody agrees with, then it's the leader's responsibility to notice the violations of those agreements, those kind of micro problems that you have, and to deal with them in a way that's fast and effective. It will stop bigger problems down the line, but it also helps team morale because it means that everybody knows that if you don't put in your best effort, then there is a way of dealing with that. So you can put in your best effort knowing that everybody else will be too. So I think there's something about leaders being there to back up their teams rather than to drive their teams.
Yeah, as you were talking, Trish, kind of my mind was going to, sure you'll be familiar with it, Project Aristotle, which was Google's research into, I think it's a few years old now, into what made great teams at Google and what separated them from the average or the poor ones. They found five things consistently. You might be able to remember the full five. I don't know. One of them was certainly, I think they found the most important was psychological safety.
Absolutely.
There was another around basically vision and prioritization, so exactly what you just spoke to us about. And there was a third one around sort of accountability as well, kind of not just the leader holding people to account, but each other holding people to account as well. I would just love to get your thoughts around that psychological safety piece.
Oh, for me, psychological safety is absolutely huge. And it's a win-win. You know, if you think about what's happening when people are not psychologically safe, then they're coming to work and they're having to protect their own identity. Like, now, I've worked with the leaders where you could go in on a day-to-day basis and not know whether you were going to get somebody that was going to be really helpful or somebody that was going to be really critical. And I know how disruptive that is to trying to work effectively and productively, because you spend so much of your time worrying about, well, you know, how am I going to cope with the person I'm going to be working with today? So there's something about consistent leadership that's really helpful. But what happens when you go in and you're trying to protect yourself is, even if you're feeling afraid or anxious or frustrated, you know, no matter how you feel going into work, you know that you can't let those emotions slip too much. So you're trying to regulate that emotion. And the part of the brain that regulates emotion, which the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, also is useful in decision-making. It's useful in recognizing the degree to which you can take a risk for the organization. If you're using it up looking after yourself, then you're not giving it to the organization in the way that's going to be useful to them. So psychological safety doesn't mean that organizations are safe places to work. There will always be risk in organizations. Psychological safety is, I feel safe so that the risks that I'm taking are for the benefit of the organization, not just for the benefit of me. Therefore, the organization wins by having psychologically safe individuals because they're bringing more of their brain to work and they're more effective. They're better at calculating the risks that they can take, taking those risks, really being involved in moving the organization forward in a way that's innovative and creative.
Wow, just what I've said wow so many times on this podcast already, but I just want to like double check kind of what I just heard you say. So I've done a fair amount of reading this year around psychological safety, but the bit I've not picked up on at all is what you've just said. So if I've got this right, you're saying the part of the brain that we use for regulating our emotions, so the part of the brain we're going to be calling on if we've got an inconsistent boss or colleague who is up and down and we never know sort of who they're going to be. If we're trying to regulate our emotions around that, we're partly using the same part of our brain that we use for making decision making. So effectively, this is me, I think, building on what you said. So if we're having to regulate our emotions a lot, we are reducing our ability to make effective decisions.
Yeah. And you reduce the willingness you have to take risk.
Wow, that's huge, isn't it? That's huge for leaders, teams, organizations.
I think it kind of frames the benefit of psychological safety away from just the individual and to the organization as well. So it's not just that you're looking after your people, which is, of course, an important thing to do, but you're looking after the organization too.
Wow, once again. Just want to circle back a couple of questions. There were so many segues in what you said to other things I wanted to talk to you about. And I know we're going to massively run out of time here. But back to this piece you mentioned around the research into four-day weeks that was done by Henley. I think I read something a few years ago that kind of one of the Scandinavian countries had done kind of some national research on that. But linked to all of that, you joined a meeting I was at a good few years ago. And one of the things that you spoke about that really resonated with me, and it links to something I hear a lot at the moment, which is slowing down to speed up. So, and when you joined that meeting, you spoke to us about, I think, two parts of the brain. There was the default mode network, I think, and it might've been the central executive network or function. Can you just talk to us a little bit about that and some of the neuroscience of slowing down to speed up and how that can help us?
Okay, so again, this comes back to this idea that your brain is using networks to get things done. And if you think about two of the major functions of leadership, one of them is there are tasks to be done and your job is to make sure that the tasks get completed. And the other is that you have to make sure that your teams work well together and that, you know, your people are okay and that team morale is kept high so that you're getting the best out of your people. So if we take those as two of the kind of primary roles of leaders and you think about, okay, so what networks in the brain would we need in order to fulfill those two very different functions? Whenever there's a task to be completed, we activate the central executive network. And it does decision-making and planning. So it's the one that kind of works out what's the goal, what are the sub-goals that we need to get there, and how do I make sure that that job gets done? When you're doing the thinking about your team, you use a different network, which is the default mode network. And the reason it's called the default mode network, it's a really strange name, is that when we first got fMRI machines, one of the questions that was asked by neuroscientists was, what does your brain do when it's doing nothing? So when you're just mind-wandering, sitting, daydreaming, that sort of thing, what is it that is still active in your brain? And the bits of the brain that are active by default, the default mode network, tend to be the parts of the brain that we now know are responsible for considering yourself in relation to others. So it's the bits of the brain that do the people-oriented stuff, the bits of the brain that think about why somebody might have behaved like that and your interactions with people and how you might improve them and, you know, how other people are interacting together and what influence you have to make that better. So these two networks are available to us for the different kinds of tasks of leadership. And you might think, well, that's fine. We'll just activate them, you know, them as we need them. But the biggest difficulty is that when one is active, the other is suppressed. So we can only really activate one at a time. You can't activate them both together. And yet many things in leadership need us both to be thinking about task and people simultaneously. So we've got a problem just in the way that our brain is structured and the way that it works. We have a problem with the kinds of tasks that we need to do in leadership. And it kind of gets a little bit worse than that, because if you're in an organization where it's really busy and full on, then there's always tasks to be done. And so you will be really, really good at getting tasks completed, because you'll be driving that network most of the time. And we know that the more we drive a particular network, the more efficiently it becomes wired. But it will be at the expense of the one that you're not using.
Right.
And when we are consistently rewarded for getting the job done, then we seek out those rewards again and again. And it can get to the stage that when you're always trying to get the job done, you begin to dehumanize the people that are doing the job. They just become the cogs in the wheel. And so you stop looking after your people. So, you know, that, you know, the thing that we've always heard about the boss that goes in and says, right, I want a report from you tomorrow on my desk, 9 o'clock. Don't care what you're doing tonight, cancel it. That's about the task becoming more important than the person. If you spend too much time in the default MoTeP network and worry about your team all the time, you can see there's a problem there, because then you don't get the job done. So we need something that allows us the time and space to operate in both of those networks. And what we know is that when you're away from work and there are no jobs to be done, your brain will naturally cycle between the two networks. And it will do the kind of strategic thinking about, well, these are the jobs that I need to get done, and who might be the best person to do them, and how might I encourage them to help me with this? And so you begin to be able to pass information between the networks so that you can do that more strategic thinking. But you have to be away from the task-oriented, busy, busy workplace in order to allow that to happen. So this is why slowing down to speed up. You'll get much better solutions. You'll get much more creative solutions. You'll get much more related. You know, you'll integrate people more into your solutions and have a better relationship with them if you can take that time to actually stop and let your brain do the work that it needs to in the way that it does it best. But that means literally putting time in your diary to do nothing. And the one thing that I do think is that when people are encouraged to do nothing and just do nothing, then that's not helpful. So one of the things that I suggest is that you spend a bit of time framing the problem. What is it that you want to have a better solution for? You know, so you really know what the elements are, and then do nothing, because then your brain's got something to work on.
Yeah, that's so interesting. What I was going to ask you, which is what you started to share with us just then anyway, Trish, was, so on a very practical level, are there any tips or tactics that you can share with us, maybe around how we structure our days, structure our weeks even, to give us the best chance of allowing each of those networks to be activated and to sort of maximize them? What can we do? So one kind of you shared is like putting time in the diary to do nothing, which is hard and scary for many people in the world of work, right? They just think if they're doing that, they're skiving or being lazy, I think, is some of the psychology perhaps we have to overcome. But what else can we be doing?
Well, I think in terms of that psychology, one of the things that I think is helpful in that is if you think about spending time doing strategic thinking. I think one of the things that when we get really busy in organizations, it's really easy to neglect is the strategic thinking. So if you were to label this your strategic thinking time and think of time that you're giving to the organization for a particular task rather than it being time for you to do nothing, I think that can be helpful. So I think that's one thing. I'm not sure whether this needs to be a regular thing or whether it would be better done as in, okay, I've got a problem now and I need some space and time to think about it. So I think if you make it just put it in my diary once a week, then that becomes, it's almost like you're creating a problem to fill the time rather than using the time to solve a problem. So yeah, it's how can you be a little bit more flexible than that? And even be aware of the time when your brain is doing this already. So where are the places in your day that you have your great moments of insight? And it can be in the shower, it can be when you're doing exercise, it can be when you're gardening or cooking, but becoming aware of when your brain is doing this for you anyway, and maybe extending that time and using it more strategically by saying, right, okay, I'm going to be doing some gardening later today, so let me set up a problem so that while I'm gardening, I can see if my brain can solve that one for me. You can begin to utilize the time that you have available better rather than trying to really force more time into the diary that you feel that you don't have. So if you really can't find those spaces to put time in, then figure out the time that you've already got and use it better. It is just a reason to slow down and to realize that we can do more sometimes when we give our brains more time to think.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you. Being conscious of time, we've probably got time for just a couple more questions that I think are linked, and there's so many I'd love to ask you, but the two are following on from what you just said around using that time maybe more effectively and framing the problem. I've sometimes seen and heard people talk about if you've got a challenge you're working on, then think about it just before you go to bed, or kind of write it down before you go to bed and let your unconscious mind work on it overnight. It sounds like that's activating the default mode network, right? What's your view on that? Does that work, or is that likely to have negative effects and stop us falling asleep and getting adequate rest?
Okay, so I would put a caveat on that, which is I think it's a great idea. You know, think about what it is you want your brain to solve before you go to bed. However, during the night, our brain shuts down the most rational parts of the brain. So if you wake up in the middle of the night and start doing the worry, worry, worry over something minute, remind yourself that you're trying to answer the problem with the less rational parts of your brain. Right. And therefore, maybe this is something that you should stop worrying about and wait until the rational bit turns on again in the morning and see if it really is a problem then.
Got you.
So the reason that it can be really effective to, and this is the double-edged sword of this, it can be really effective to think about a problem overnight is because you will get more creative solutions when your rational brain's not going, oh, no, we can't do that. So you come up with solutions that are maybe suppressed by our more rational thinking. But you also have to be careful that we don't just become, you know, worry mongers and do that, you know, just rolling over a problem again and again and again and not being able to come up with the solution because our rational brain is not involved too.
Got you. And again, there's a lovely segue. So thank you for setting up what's probably the final question. So I read something a couple of years ago. I think it was by Dan Pink, and I may have this wrong. So if I'm kind of quoting what he wrote in his book wrong, then apologies, Dan, if you're out there. But I think basically the gist of what I read was he was saying, regardless of whether or not we think we might be a morning person or a night owl, that most of us tend to be most productive and effective in the mornings. And I think then what he was suggesting was that we should try to use our mornings for sort of the high value work where we really need to be working on solving a problem, doing some detailed high impact work, sort of early afternoon for low priority stuff such as admin type tasks, and then keep the afternoons clear for more creative work. And again, I think he was suggesting that's because the very rational parts of our brains is less likely to jump in and shut down creative ideas too soon. So is there any hard science to any of that, or is that another one of these myths or things that have been sort of misinterpreted?
Okay, so I think there's probably a couple of things that are being mixed up within that. So there's certainly evidence that teenagers work better if you let them get up later and during the day. So the idea that there aren't people that are not good first thing in the morning, I'm not sure that I would agree with that. What I do agree with, and maybe this is what was being got at here, is that our decision-making processes are freshest in the morning. So if you've got difficult decisions to make, then absolutely you should try and make them when, and it doesn't matter when, you know, if you're a 10 o'clock person, then make them then. It's whenever your brain is freshest rather than it being very first thing in the morning.
So it's more about making those quite soon after you've woken up and started your day rather than necessarily the morning. So if you got up at 11 o'clock, then do it soon after that when you start your day, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and it's partly because we seem to be able to assess risk better when our brains are at their most resourceful. So one of the studies that this is based on is work with there's judges in Israel who were being asked to make decisions about parole and whether particular parole cases could be let free or not. And it turned out they did a study where they looked at what times during the day people were most likely to be given parole. And it was first thing in the morning and just after lunch. And what they were suggesting was that the ability to assess the risk at those points in time was better because effectively, as we have to do more and more of it, the system becomes less effective. It's almost like you're running from a decision-making battery. It's not a battery, but because it doesn't drain completely. But we're better at taking high-risk decisions or assessing high-risk decisions early on than we are later during the day. So I think maybe that's what I would say, you know, do your decision-making first thing when you're at your most resourceful and most alert, and then do the less taxing tasks later on in the day.
Got it. So this is what people are talking about when we talk about decision fatigue, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. Trish, thank you so much for coming on the show. Rather selfishly, I almost don't care how much value everybody else has got from this because I've taken huge, huge value from it. Like, you've helped me so much personally. You've dispelled so many myths and really linked. You've done what you do, right? You really have linked so much of the science to the practical day-to-day for all of us, regardless of whether we're leading big teams or not. So thank you so much.
It's been a very great fellowship. Thank you.
I was going to say, if people want to know more, find out more about you, some of the programs that you run, what's the best way for people to get in touch?
Easily enough to get onto my LinkedIn profile and contact me through it. If you want a bit more reading, there's a book called The Neuroscience of Leadership Coaching that I co-wrote with some colleagues at Henley that's very practical. Otherwise, a lot of the courses that I run is through an organization called ITS, International Teaching Seminars, so you could look me up there.
Amazing. What we'll do, we'll put all of those links in the show notes for people. So if they want to know more, get in touch, they can just click on those and find you really easily that way. So thank you once again for being on the show. Whatever you're doing, have a great day.
And you, Ben. It's been a real pleasure.
There you have it, folks. My interview with Professor Patricia Riddell. A particular highlight for me was what she shared around how, as leaders, we need to use both the central executive network and the default mode network in order to deliver the results and to look after those who, in my words, we have the privilege and responsibility to lead. But the most fascinating part about that for me was how, when one of these networks is activated, the other is effectively shut down or switched off. For me, again, this really does seem to be the hard scientific evidence that supports the idea of slowing down in order to speed up. Before you go, do also take a couple of minutes to check out my new online personal leadership mastery program that is designed to help us all play at our absolute best in the fast-paced, complex, and uncertain world that we are all now living and leading in. It is also designed to help us all prepare for the post-COVID world that hopefully is coming very, very soon. The program brings together a collection of the best tips, techniques, tools, templates to help leaders at all levels reach peak performance. For a one-off license fee, you can access over 3 hours of videos and more than 15 toolkits and models. All of the details are via the link in the show notes, but for now, the course focuses on 7 key topics or areas. How to thrive in a volatile and complex world, creating daily, weekly, quarterly, and annual planning protocols, defining and being true to your personal values, practicing state mastery, and how to carry out a 3PM audit to battle-proof your mindset. I'm really proud of this content, folks, and I hope that you'll see it as a great opportunity to boost and develop yourself and your colleagues and get ready for whatever the year ahead throws at us. And finally, I've also included a 30% discount code for you in the show notes as well as a thank you for being a fan and supporter of the podcast. That's it for this episode. Stay safe, stay well, and lead on.